Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. We're wrapping up our October Domestic Violence Awareness Month series today with a couple of true frontline responders when a domestic violence victim or witness makes a call for help. We're going to visit the Newtown Emergency Communications Center and Police Department to speak first with a respected emergency telecommunications leader, as well as a police sergeant heading up Newtown's new community policing division, to explain exactly what to expect in those first few crucial moments when you call 911 for help. Then we're going to head up to the Connecticut Electric Car Charging Systems in Newington for a live visit to help celebrate the 10th anniversary of this company, who helped install the state's first few electric vehicle charging stations. Well, 10 years and hundreds of charging stations later, this company's on track to hook up hundreds more in the coming years. And we're going to find out why that's so important as we chat with the company's owner, as well as members of key state and federal delegations in attendance. So stay tuned. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this kicking reminder. That's right, the third annual Veterans Kickathon, presented by the American Tangsudo Association and KMAS Karate to benefit Homes for the Brave, is happening on Saturday, November 5th from noon to 2 at InSports in Trumbull on Trefoil Drive. Karate students from around the region have been collecting donations for the number of kicks they're going to execute during a 90-minute period. Volunteer kick counters are going to count and record those numbers that each student completes, and spectators are encouraged to come out and cheer them on. And all proceeds benefit Homes for the Brave, which is providing veterans the housing services necessary for those experiencing homelessness so they can return to a productive and meaningful life. Learn about how you can help this organization by visiting homesforthebrave.org. So we are pleased here during this last segment of our Domestic Violence Awareness Month series to be the guests of the Newtown Police Department and the Newtown Emergency Communications Department. I am starting this segment with Maureen Will. She's the Newtown Director of Emergency Communications and a well-known and nationally known telecommunicator leader. Also served an entire career as a police officer here in Connecticut, so she knows both sides of the job and the challenges that law enforcement and emergency telecommunicators have when taking those calls for domestic violence situations, and she also has the experience to be able to explain what you should know, whether you're calling in immediate danger or after an assault, or you're a loved one who might be calling on behalf of someone you fear is in danger or has been assaulted. So, Maureen, thank you so much for your time today. And if we could start by just letting people know about the way the first voice on the phone or the first responder to the text or other type of outreach is trained and has developed a certain level of expertise in being able to effectively handle that call for help.
Well, each of the telecommunicators are specifically trained in domestic violence. They'll have it at their training academies, and they'll also go through some in-service training here at their own ECCs, both with just their director and with law enforcement. So when you call or when you text to 911, and sometimes that texting to 911 might be your only option, but if you can call, you're going to get someone who knows right away that there's a problem, and they're going to start asking you some questions. The first thing they're going to want to know is, are you safe? And if you can tell them yes or no answers are fine, excuse me, But if you're not safe, they're going to try to direct you to either leave the residence, leave the business, hide somewhere, not in a bathroom. We do not want you going to bathrooms. But any place that you can secure a door and be safe and stay on that phone with us. Even if you can't say anything, we are going to be your eyes and ears. So when we can talk to you, we're going to ask you, do you know who the person is who's been assaulting you? Are there weapons in the house? And we all go under the impression that there are weapons in a house because there's knives, there's chairs, there's anything can be used as a weapon. But we're looking for guns or bows and arrows, hunting knives, things that...
Lethal
weapons, things like that. And if you are hurt, because we'll start to stage EMS to make sure that you can get the medical attention that you need. We're also going to ask if there's children in the house. Those are the other important commodities that we want to make sure are safe. And can you see them? Can you hear them? We'll ask you information about the assailant. How do you know him? Are you married? We'll ask if there's any protective orders or restraining orders that might be out. Because the whole time that we're talking to you, we are now doing some research. We're in our CAD system, which is our computer-aided dispatch, and we're looking up, do we know who you are? Do we know who you where you live? Someone else is going to go into the national computer if you say, yes, there's a protective order, and we're going to get that information. If we know the name of the assailant, we're going to be looking him or her up, and we'll see if there's guns registered to them or if they've ever been arrested before. So there's a lot of activity that's going on, and at the same time, although you can't hear it, we are dispatching law enforcement. It seems like forever that it takes forever for them to get there, but usually it's only a matter of minutes, and we're going to send out every resource that we have. The other things that if you can't say anything, even a yes or no answer, that's the most anything you can do to help us is going to help us tell the responders what they're walking into.
So that begs the question, would the dispatcher maybe ask the person if they can't make noise, if they could like tap the phone once for yes and twice for no, that type of tactic?
Correct. We will do anything in our power to make sure that we can get to that. And if you're on a cell phone, we'll then ask you to start texting. We'll tell you to text to 911, anything.
And keeping the line open is another critical thing. Don't think you've delivered your message and hang up if you're in crisis.
The only time you should hang up is when we tell you to hang up. And if it becomes that dangerous that you don't want to be seen with the phone in your hand, put it down beside you. Push it away from you. Push the receiver away from you so that the assailant can't see it and doesn't understand that 911 has been activated.
Now, I bet there's a segment of listeners who are paying close attention, even though it's early on a Sunday morning, and they're going, why not the bathroom? Why shouldn't I escape to the bathroom?
It's too small, and you can be trapped very easily in a bathroom. Think of it as a closet. You can't move. You can't see. And in a bathroom, you can be drowned in a bathtub. You can't even get out a window because most of the windows are too small.
Yeah. So there may be more pointy objects,
yeah,
things like that.
Be.
Yeah. Okay. So we have learned in our prior interviews that there has been a measurable increase in domestic violence emergencies involving men who are being assaulted. So rest assured, no matter whether you're a male, female, or identifying in some other way, it doesn't matter. If you're calling for help, you're going to be treated the same way. Men should not be concerned or afraid or have any reason to fear they're going to be treated differently if they call and they are being victimized.
That is correct. And it is when a male calls us for help, that is it's at the point of almost lethality because it's very embarrassing to let someone know that your wife or your spouse has been, a significant other has been abusing you. And that's just the way we've all grown up. But believe me, these officers, they've seen it all. They do not judge. You are who you are, and we'll call you a survivor. We're not going to call you a victim. You are a survivor. So please do not hesitate to call. And we also have a lot of resources that are available to men here in the community and in the Danbury area.
So to wrap things up with this piece of the interview, Maureen, I guess the last thing would be on the part of the concerned bystander, whether that bystander is a child, a parent, a neighbor, a coworker, or somebody who just saw something they think is going wrong in the parking lot of their local grocery store. Do you treat the – I don't say treat, but do you – is there a different line of questioning that the caller might expect, or is there anything else important that the caller should take note of to be able to tell the telecommunicator when they call 911?
We're going to be asking you for descriptions, you know, male, female, color – height, what they're wearing. If they're in a vehicle, please, a plate number always helps out. The registration, front or back, anything distinguishing that you see. But the more information that you have, the more we can give to the responding officers to keep them safe and to keep our survivors safe. So anything at all, don't be afraid to call. There's nothing silly about it. A lot of violent crimes have been stopped because you've said something. So please call us and be patient with us when we do ask you the questions, because it's important.
And it would be a rare, if even non-existent, situation where a 911 call would be routed to a telecommunicator who is alone on their job. So typically, I would say almost exclusively, if someone is calling 911, they need to know that the conversation that they're having with the person they're talking to, at the same time, everything that they're saying is being related and help is on the way.
That is correct. There is many times I have been in here because I relieve staff because they had to step out for a second, and those calls have come in, and we handle it because that's our job, and we do it very, very well.
Any final pieces of advice in the world of domestic violence awareness and prevention, just based on your experience both as a law enforcement officer and a telecommunicator, that it's important for people to know?
Please don't be afraid to call us. We don't tell people who you are other than the law enforcement who is responding. You need to trust us. We are there to help you.
Maureen Will, Director of Emergency Communications in the town of Newtown. Thank you so much for your information today.
You're welcome, sir.
So we're going to close out our series on Domestic Violence Awareness Month with arguably one of the most critical agencies involved in the entire process. We've already spoken to Maureen Will regarding the emergency telecommunications piece. Then they hand off, as you heard, to the responders. We're here with Sergeant Will Chapman of the Newtown Police Department, who's also in charge of the Community Policing Division and helping with the department's communications efforts. So he's the logical person to speak with. So, Sergeant Chapman, let's start out with that handoff. We learned that you're in the car receiving a lot of information, or as much information as can be gathered at the telecommunications end of things, while another telecommunicator is likely still on the, hopefully still on the line with the threatened individual or the victim or the witness. So what's happening in the vehicle and in the mind of the responder in those few moments until they arrive on the scene and encounter the caller?
Sure. Well, our primary consideration is, you know, at that point is getting the information we need to arrive to where we're interacting with the person safely. So honestly, it goes everything from us driving carefully, us parking, you know, strategically so we can approach the house safely, us knocking on the door safely and positioning ourselves in a safe space so that, you know, unfortunately, as we know too well, sometimes any call, but historically a domestic dispute are calls where somebody's well aware that the police are coming, and somebody that has a desire to do harm to the police will use that as their opportunity to do so. So that's our first consideration. As we're gathering that information and talking to dispatch, we're thinking, how am I going to put myself in a position to best help this person, because we can't help them if we don't show up to their front door. Once we're with the person, our primary focus shifts to their safety. We become the person that showed up to help them stay safe in a situation where they felt unsafe. And so whatever we can do, whether it's to remove them from the situation, create space between them and the person they're calling against. You know, these calls vary across a broad spectrum of, you know, threats of violence to, you know, financial intimidation or emotional manipulation to actual physical violence being used against another person. So whatever we have to do within those circumstances to help our victim feel physically and emotionally safe, we'll do that.
You brought up a spectacular point, because of prior interviews in this series have talked about a lot of other scenarios besides putting hands on or striking a victim. So the calls to the police are appropriate when somebody directly feels they are a victim of the emotional abuse or the financial abuse. Or if a witness or loved one is suspecting it.
Yeah, you know, I equate it to these. There's certainly ways that we need to look at these calls objectively.
Sure.
However, we don't determine how someone else feels. And I think about my one of my young sons. He's had some bad experiences in the past with stinging insects. And mm-hmm. So if he encounters a wasp or a yellow jacket or a hornet, he'll engage in sort of an air karate match, you know, and, you know, there's a very real fear and anxiety in him that causes him to have that reaction. Now, as an adult, as somebody who cares for him and has been around these insects for a while, I know that, hey, if you just keep calmly walking through it, you know, you'll be okay. And it's difficult to get him to understand that in the moment, because he's coming from a very real place of real fear and anxiety that's real to him. Mm-hmm. And so it's important to consider that, you know, not to oversimplify the terror of somebody that's being emotionally or financially or physically manipulated. But oftentimes that's why we're there. We're there to help them kind of walk through that terror and realize, like, hey, we're here to walk calmly with you through this, because we know that you'll be okay if you allow us to help you through this.
Yeah, so, and if not law enforcement, then who?
Yeah. So, you know, there's certainly, you know, I feel like I'm losing track a little bit of how we started on that point, but, you know, there's
people should call for something other than being hit,
right,
or struck physically,
yeah,
harmed, so, and victimized.
Yeah. So there's loads of resources we have for people in those positions. And there's loads of ways that we can help align them with the folks that can help them build the skills and the confidence to, you know, be made whole again. And sometimes, quite frankly, that's we don't need to even look at it through that good guy, bad guy lens, mm-hmm, right? You know, just in the same way that, you know, people experience the intimidation of another, sometimes people act out in such a way because they themselves are unwell, mm-hmm, because they need, you know, there's resources, there's skills that they don't have. They're going through something that causes them to respond to their emotions in a way that has a harmful effect on others. Mm-hmm. And it's important for us always to consider the, you know, when we enter into a situation, it's not good guy, bad guy.
Yeah.
It's victim and, you know, suspect. And the suspect often also needs some resources, some help. So,
yeah. And suffice to say, law enforcement has come light years, mm-hmm, in the past 20 physical years in terms of, you know, just both people get, all parties involved get arrested and it gets sorted out later. It's usually you know, minimal involvement on the part of the immediate responder. These days, the immediate responder, you go through a lethality checklist with the individual. You have a decent amount of resource information to give to them, and may sometimes even be with the individual until human service representative is able to physically get the handoff, right?
Right. And there's, you know, I can think throughout my career of situations I've been in where that call to the police for someone who was emotionally unwell and treating their family in such a way that, you know, no family should have to endure physical violence from a loved one. But when we start to get into those other areas, that, you know, the more emotional and circumstantial areas with these calls, oftentimes that call to the police can be the thing that saves, that can save a marriage, can save a family from, you know, being in a situation where we have kids that are, you know, have to spend time outside the home with another agency or another parent. You know, not that, you know, every family, every situation is so different, but it's important to consider that all the people that we're dealing with are people, and they're taking their own unique, you know, thoughts and feelings and emotions into these situations. And so,
it's important to say, this is not your individual philosophy. This is training that's protocol across all law enforcement, at least in Connecticut, right?
Absolutely, yeah. It's important to remember that absolutely there should be accountability and sometimes strict accountability in the moment for, you know, somebody who's doing wrong. And as the police often were tasked with being the ones that separate that person out from the situation and put them in front of, you know, a judge, put them in front of whatever, you know, person is going
to
facilitate that accountability.
Yeah, right.
And that's an important piece of it. And, you know, we should never shy away from making those decisions when they have to be made. But even while we're doing that, a part of that process for us is, you know, valuing somebody as a human. And, you know, if there's an opportunity to help them, you know, providing them with that help so that they can move on from that incident and have a healthy relationship with their family, have a healthy relationship as a parent or, you know, a spouse.
Yeah.
It's something that's
important. It could be a turning point to a better life for everyone involved, right?
Yeah.
So we heard a lot from Maureen about the litany of questions that's being asked for appropriate reasons to make sure that it's dovetailing with the safety of the responders. Will the responding officer often ask duplicative questions? And if so, you know, please reassure people that are calling that, it's part of the process. It's not any disrespect or that the dispatcher didn't believe them, but it's, you know, why is it important to have that corroborating information, you know, in the 5 or 10 minute period between the phone call to emergency dispatch and then the officer's arrival and initial interview?
Well, and the first thing, you know, to mention is that it's pretty rare that we're actually talking about a 5 to 10 minute phone call. So our emergency communicators are so good that often, again, one is giving us information real time while the other is getting information from the caller. So it allows us to be on our way. So certainly we're bound by, you know, gravity and physics and, yeah, you know, all these other things. But
I'm watching too much Alaska Highway Patrol, I think.
Yeah. I have nothing but good things to say about the Alaska State Troopers as well.
Yeah.
But we have, you know, we're going to get there as quickly as we can while this information is coming through. So, so when we get there, it is likely that we'll ask a lot of duplicate questions. We'll ask a lot of the same things that, and it'll seem like, well, I just said all that to the dispatcher. You know, similar to when you're, you know, calling to cancel your cable, and you have to, you know, you go from one person to another,
sure,
and
yeah,
you have to give your name and password every single time.
Yeah.
It's, you know, what we're doing is paying that incident its due respect and making sure that nothing gets missed. Because when you're face-to-face with a person, you can ask a question that they answered one way to the dispatcher, and what we'll pick up on is something that's said just slightly differently, or a facial expression, or something that can only, you know, be found in the intimacy of that face-to-face interaction. And that'll allow us space to ask a follow-up question that follow-up question might be our way to really help. that follow-up question might be the, you know, the indicator that, hey, this isn't just a today thing. This is something that happens, you know, every day. This is something that happens every day when so-and-so comes home from work, or anytime this happens, or anytime there's this circumstance, and we start to realize that this person isn't just calling because they're frustrated today. This person's calling because it's their last resort. They've tried everything that they can think to try because this has happened 100 times. And sometimes it's that second follow-up question that we get that gets us to that place. So as annoying and frustrating as it is sometimes to answer the same questions multiple times, it's really important to us as investigators that we ask those duplicate questions.
How about in terms of, to wrap things up, about physical evidence gathering? Oftentimes, the intimate partner violence may come with both a physical assault or a sexual assault. These days, my understanding is that officers throughout Connecticut, whether they're departmental or state police, they have actually almost like a kind of a small laboratory worth of evidence gathering equipment that they begin to use, on the front line, even before detectives might be involved, if they are.
Well, we have a lot of certainly resources and training available as far as evidence gathering and scene processing go. Our primary concern, if we're talking about specifically those instances of physical or sexual violence, our primary concern is something has happened. You know, if we're speaking to a victim, and we would probably use different language face-to-face with the victim, but something's happened to you that has taken your control over your body away from you. Our job is to, while we're preserving the crime scene, our job is to start the process of putting you back in control of what happens to you in your body. So any photo that we have to take of bruising or marks or scars, any evidence that we have to take, whether it's on the scene or at the hospital, it's always done through that lens of, you know, trying to restore as much as we can that person's, you know, self-worth. So, you know, if I have to take a, you know, if I have to interview a victim, if I have to take a photo of, let's say, a black eye, that might look something like me saying, you know, I'd like to come over here to this room. Is that okay? I'd like to sit here. Is that okay? I'd like to take a photo of your, you know, you have a mark over your eye. We'd like to get you some help for that. Is that okay? I'd like to get a photo of that. Is that okay? And, you know, just continually trying to reassure the person that, you know, we're there to value them as a person. And we're there to show them that respect and to make them feel like they're in control of what's happening to them. Certainly, sometimes in moments like that, we have to get the evidence that we need to play the long game and help that person in the long run. So we may have to be less gentle and less if we need to take a picture frame that was broken, if we need to take an item, if we need to take a photograph, and that photograph is going to be the hinge pin of the case, we might have to tread a little heavier. But by and large, our main goal is to help, while we're gathering our evidence, is to help restore that person.
Excellent. Sergeant Will Chapman here at the Newtown Police Department, wrapping up our Domestic Violence Awareness Month series here at the award-winning For the People. Sergeant, thank you so much. Very valuable information today.
Thank you.
Hey, do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting a fundraiser or community building activity, or you'd like to find a nonprofit to support in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the events tab, and find one, or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Voquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media, and we'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Hey, Halloween is a fun and spooky time of year for kids, and you want to make sure trick-or-treating is safe for your little monsters with a few safety tips from the National Fire Protection Association. When choosing a costume, make sure you're staying away from long, trailing fabric. Provide children with flashlights to carry for lighting or glow sticks as part of their costume. Don't forget dried flowers, corn stalks, and crepe paper catch fire easily, so keep all decorations away from open flames. And while you're at it, why not use battery-operated candles or glow sticks inside jack-o'-lanterns instead of live candles? And tell children to stay away from open flames, including jack-o'-lanterns with candles in them. Be sure they know how to stop, drop, and roll if their clothing catches fire. And if you want more information on Halloween safety or fire safety for your home and family, just go to nfpa.org.
Well, we are here on a big day for Ed Ingalls with the Connecticut Electric Car Charging Systems Company. We're all the way up here in Newington because this is a day that is so important for everyone in Connecticut, not only the ones who already own electric vehicles, but for the thousands or tens of thousands that are going to be acquiring them over the coming years. And we know you're out there, folks. We know there are some of you who are still worried about where you're going to charge these vehicles once you leave the comfort of your own home. And in 10 years, Ed, you've been providing that answer.
Yeah, well, 10 years ago, fast forward to today, the range on these vehicles have increased, you know, threefold. We just wired in an electric car charging station for a friend of mine that bought an H2. You know, a Hummer H2. It's got 400-mile range on that vehicle. And a lot of the other vehicles that have less than that, you know, 200, 300-mile range, people have to remember that when they buy an electric car, especially if they're more than one vehicle in the driveway, the chances of them running that vehicle down to less than even 50% on a daily basis or a weekly basis, nil. I mean, like I said, I've talked to lots and lots of car people that have electric cars. They have an electric car, they go to work, they go here, they go there. Sometimes they don't plug in and recharge their car for 3-4 days. And when they do plug in, they still have 50% charge left. So the average guy that has an electric car does not have to worry about recharging his car. Gets home, he plugs in. It's the people that are trying to use the electric car to, let's say, go across country. But I mean, there's a lot of other choices that you have to go across country with. Mm-hmm. But there are those people that say, no, I want to go to Ohio or Oklahoma. And well, for them, that's maybe a little different. They have to plop their way around. But for the average guy like you or I, want to buy an electric car and you might have another vehicle in your driveway, you're not going to ever charge that car full, ever. It's never going to go past 50%.
So you and I look about the same age. So we come from a time when maybe if we didn't, maybe our parents owned a vehicle that still put leaded gas in the tank,
oh,
right?
Yeah.
So 10, 12 years ago, what were you doing and what was it that inspired you to steer into this line of work?
Well, you know, we're electrical contractors. I own and operate Newington Electric Company. I've been in the business for since I've been 12 years old with my father. He started Newington Electric.
Yeah.
So I'm an electrical contractor first and foremost. And to wire these electric car charging stations, you need to be an electrical contractor. So it was a good fit. When I saw Chevy Volt out there and I saw Nissan Leaf and they were not going away, it was a pretty good bet that this was here to stay. So we sort of put some feelers out there and said, hey, let's start up a company that's going to specialize in installing and wiring electric car charging stations. People are going to need that. So that's sort of what we did, and it's been working pretty well.
We heard from the speakers here today that not only is the federal government and the state government, but also Eversource as a utility, all providing financial assistance
Huge.
And underwriting
Huge.
For people to get this show on the road. What do folks, from your perspective, need to know about putting the charging end of the electric vehicle experience into their home or workplace?
Well, what they need to know. If they don't know, they can call our company. But right now, Eversource, State of Connecticut, has some incredible rebate programs going on right now, and they're going to be available from what I hear, for the next 9 years. And on the residential end, you can get pretty much 100% of your installation on your electric car charging station rebated back to you. On the commercial end, the same thing. On these commercial chargers, you can go from anywhere from $25,000 up to $250,000 to install car charging stations at a commercial facility, like an apartment building or a complex, condominium complex. Yeah. And it's very important to people because people live there and they want to buy an electric car for various reasons. And these property owners are going to be able to now install these electric car charging stations at no cost to them because they're going to get it rebated, and they're going to be enable their tenants to be able to buy an electric car and come in and plug into it when they get back to their apartment building. So these rebates are key, unbelievable.
Very great. Well, congratulations on 10 years in this business. May you have as many more as you care to engage. Thank you so much, Ed Ingalls, here with Connecticut Electric Car Charging Systems and this great celebration. We're going to talk to some really important people. You really drew the VIPs here today, Ed.
We did. Yeah, we had people from Newington to the state of Connecticut to Washington. So it worked out pretty well. Yeah,
it's nice to know you got that kind of team behind you.
Yeah, it is nice. Yeah, we have a lot of support. We've been around for a while. I don't want to blow my own horn, but we have a great reputation. These people are not afraid to put their name behind our reputation, and that's really nice to know. It's a good feeling. So,
heartiest congratulations to you and the whole Connecticut Electric Car team.
Thank you, sir. Thanks, John.
So, the number of the day is $52 million, and you played a critical role in helping Connecticut access that money to fortify the initiative that we're here today. Senator Richard Blumenthal is here with us in Newington, but really representing the entire state of Connecticut that is, thanks to his good work, so progressive in terms of making sure the people who make that huge investment in electric vehicles are very confident that they'll be able to get where they need to go or be able to recharge in the process of getting there.
The investment by the federal government is critical in electric charging stations as well as in electric vehicles. And the rebates, the tax credits are going to be absolutely central. They'll be key to providing people with real incentives to go electric in their cars. The 4,000 on used cars, the 7,000 and on new cars, and then the investment in the charging stations themselves. These millions of dollars will pay off in huge dividends for our environment and also for people's wallets and pocketbooks, because they will save money. And the United States is going to be energy independent, more so than we are now. So we don't have to kowtow to the Saudis or to Russia. We will be above any kind of dictators and tyrants having influence on us. Right now, we are certainly fighting Russia, and we need to leverage Saudi Arabia so they provide more oil and gasoline in the short term. But in the long term, electric vehicles are our future.
When it comes to top-down support, you can't get any better than having a backer like the President of the United States of America.
The President of the United States is all in on electric vehicles, and not just because they're going to be made in America. They're going to be providing good jobs and careers to people in America. They're going to be making America completely energy independent because we'll use less fossil fuels and we'll help to save the planet. So that's the reason that in the United States Senate, I am such an advocate. It's a cause that's a win-win-win for everyone, including American consumers who are clamoring for these electric vehicles. And we need to make the supply chain for microchips and semiconductors also American. That's why we passed the Science and Chips Act, to bring back that supply chain from China. We can't be dependent on China for semiconductors. We can't depend on Saudi Arabia for oil. We need to be independent.
When you look at this critical point of light across myriad issues that you have to deal with as a United States senator in the next few years on your agenda. How does the growth of what we're talking about here today in Newington fit into your schedule?
I'm going to take this picture of what's happening here in Newington, the Connecticut Electric Charging Company, down to Washington with me and say to my colleagues, the future is here now. This company is making it possible for the dream to be realized. It's no longer a vision, it's a reality. And we can spread the word and provide more electric charging facilities so that people will feel secure when they leave in the morning. They got enough fuel, energy, they can come back in the evening and recharge their car, whether at home or at their condominium or at work, at their place of business. And that security will further embolden and enlarge the number of electric vehicles we have. And it is so important because it gives everyone a chance to help. Often I'm asked as a U.S. Senator, what can I do to help save the planet? And the answer is buy an electric vehicle, conserve energy, use renewables. There are such simple things that people are clamoring to do, and I think this kind of enterprise makes it more possible. It's due to an entrepreneur, Ed Ingalls, who really put his financial future on the line.
And truth be told, this is something being embraced across a greater, growing bipartisan group.
It is a bipartisan movement. It should be non-political in the sense of one side versus another. We ought to come together as a country and embrace it. And I hope it will, in fact, enable us to come together more as a country. One of the central challenges right now is to heal our divisions and bring ourselves together rather than hurling insults at one another. And I think this kind of environmental and business opportunity will help to do it because it really is a win-win for everyone.
And the fact that we all want to breathe clean air, irrelevant of our political persuasion, is important.
These days, people get it. They want to breathe clean air. They no longer want to walk or ride behind an emissions-spewing automobile that you can smell now. It's a little bit like, you know, cigarette smoke.
Yeah.
People now are so sensitive, they'll walk into a room, even if no one's smoking, and say, I don't want to be in here because it smells of cigarette. Well, that is the kind of repugnance and revulsion that we will see with fossil fuel burning vehicles.
U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. Okay.
Well, we've heard her voice several times on the award-winning For the People, and it's great to finally be here with her. Katie Dykes, Commissioner of the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. Katie, great to see you in person. So first and foremost, as an EV owner, what do you have to say to the folks who still have grave concerns about making these, you know, substantially greater investment in acquiring those vehicles, who may still be concerned about how they're going to get to where they've got to go? What can you say in terms of the technology that's available within the vehicles, first of all, to stretch those batteries and that distance access?
The technology is getting better and better every year. I bought, my family purchased an electric vehicle in 2019. Mm. Even as the Deep Commissioner, I'd never driven an EV before. And so, you know, everyone has a little bit of trepidation, a little bit of like, what's this like? This feels, you know, this seems strange, you know. So the first thing I encourage everybody is go down to your dealership and just test drive an EV. First and foremost, they're amazingly fun to drive. They have great pickup and they're incredibly like affordable. Folks might be surprised to hear that, but here's what's going on. When we purchased our EV, we found after trading in our vehicle and then factoring in $7,500 worth of tax credits from the federal government, which have just been extended by Congress with the Inflation Reduction Act, plus over $2,000 average rebate that is provided at the state level thanks to the cheaper rebate program that we've been implementing for several years now. We actually found it was, we saved money on switching over to an electric vehicle. And that's even before factoring in the cost that the fuel is cheaper. It's definitely cleaner. as we're powering our electric grid with solar and nuclear and soon offshore wind. And the operation and the maintenance costs for an electric vehicle are also lower. But of course, the big question that people have, the number one question we hear is, how far is that battery going to last, and where am I going to charge? And so the good news is that since January this year, Eversource and United Illuminating are offering really generous incentives to help reduce the cost of installing an electric vehicle charger at home. Charging an EV is a lot like charging your iPhone. It's just you plug it in every night and you top off that battery. And in a state like Connecticut, where most trips that people are taking are, we're not a big state. Yeah, you find that... I rarely am in a situation where I'm running out of battery charge. But in that situation, now we have $52 million just approved by the U.S. Department of Transportation that will be invested in putting in charging stations all across our major transportation corridors. So in addition to having an at-home charger, which when I installed mine with the rebates was practically free, now you'll also have chargers available in those strip malls and along the highways and all those places that you're going so that you can top up if you need it. So it's never been a better time to think about purchasing an EV, but it starts with going down and test driving one.
So if you're in Stamford and commuting to Norwich or Norwich to Stamford, nothing to worry about. I'm so glad you brought up alternate generation, because I've read a lot, but I have read very little about the connection between the proliferation of in-home solar charging and the connection that can play with electric vehicles in terms of, responding to critics who may say, well, you're just plugging in and making somebody else create the fossil fuel footprint.
Well, the good news is...
carbon footprint.
Yeah, the great question, John, and I get it all the time. And the good news is that even before we started working on switching vehicles over to electric, we've been working for 20 years on cleaning up our grid so that we'd have the cleanest electricity possible to fuel all these vehicles that are shifting over to electric. So, for example, right now we're over 50% of our electricity is carbon-free. When you consider we have the Millstone Nuclear Facility, largest power generator, totally emission-free, right down in Waterford, powering a big portion of our grid. We have hundreds of megawatts of solar that we've been installing on people's roofs and grid-scale projects. We have invested in offshore wind. So by 2026 or so, we're expecting about 20% of our power supply will be coming from emission-free turbines spinning off the coast of Martha's Vineyard. So all of those investments in a carbon-free grid mean cleaner and cleaner power going into our cars. But, you should also know that electric vehicles are just much more efficient in the way that they use energy than internal combustion engine vehicles. So even without factoring in the emissions on the power grid, they're also just a much more energy efficient technology than a gas-powered vehicle.
Great information this morning from the Commissioner of DEEP, Katie Dykes, who's a great friend of ours and a great resource to the For the People. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you so much, John.
Representing Eversource here today, a voice that has not been heard on For the People for many, many years, and glad to talk to him again, Enoch Lenge. Enoch, you're sort of, excuse the pun, but you're plugged right into this initiative like hip deep. What's the most important thing you as a representative of the company that's going to be able to help provide the power to get all these electric vehicles, not just out on the road and into people's garages, but from point to point on longer and longer and longer ride days and commutes. What's the most important thing that folks in Connecticut need to know?
I think the key is that we work with all of our customers, and we're getting more and more interest, request, participation in charging stations. And so we work with them on the installation and helping them install the charging stations at their homes, at their businesses. We've seen a tremendous uptick and interest, to the rate of 1,200 residential homes over the past 12 months, or past 10 months, have participated and installed the EV charging station. And then on the commercial side, all different types of businesses, you know, different communities are installing charging stations. They're taking advantage of the programs, the rebates and the incentives. And so on the commercial side, you know, again, we're seeing, you know, huge participation rates. Over 2,000 chargers are planning to be installed, and some of them are in process of being installed right now in different towns and communities and businesses throughout the state. So over the next 6 months, we'll see those charging stations in public areas and in businesses. So it'll make that accessible to folks, whether they decide to charge at home or they're out and about and they're looking for a charging station. Now they'll have those available. And so working with customers, understanding their needs, understanding their unique business and what they're trying to achieve, what types of charger, what amount of time they're looking to provide customers for a charge time when they plug in, how long it will take, helping them come up with the right solution is really what we do in our team at Eversource.
I guess when people finally get to the point where economically they're able to cross that new chapter into the ownership of an electric vehicle, sometimes they don't realize the added cost of having to equip their home with the ability to charge it. And it's great to hear that Eversource is so far behind the effort to make that component of EV ownership so affordable.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that these programs, they really make it easier to install the charging station. So, you know, as an example, if installing a charger at home, you know, the actual charger itself could range from $600 to $800, and the rebate is $500. So it offsets a big chunk of the cost. Or in addition to just the charger, usually you have to do a wiring upgrade to put the proper plug in your garage or outside your home. And so that could range, you know, from $1,000 to $1,500, but there's a rebate of $500 for that. So the rebates offset a pretty big chunk of the cost, where it brings it, you know, down, and it's, you know, intended to help make the adoption of EVs and making, you know, the charging easier, an easier decision for folks to move forward with.
Thanks for the input, Enoch Lenge with Eversource here today at this great event celebrating 10 years with this company, NEC, and Connecticut Electric Car Charging Systems. Thank you, Enoch.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we're here joined by Governor Ned Lamont. So, Governor, you've so aggressively pushed for making electric vehicles more available to folks of every stripe all across the state of Connecticut. This is the next logical piece of the puzzle. In the next 4 years, how are you going to help support the availability of access to help folks make sure these vehicles get to where they got to go?
Well, we're here at CT Electric Car. It's their 10th anniversary. They will point out the number of EVs being sold in the state is doubling almost every year right now. One of the things that holds it back is EV charging stations. So thanks to help from Congress and what we're doing locally, there are going to be EV charging stations every 50 miles on all of our major thoroughfares. Mm. So, John, you won't have to suffer from any more range anxiety.
Yeah.
And I think we're going to have all electric transportation system over the next 15, 20 years.
You made a spectacular point about putting one in every church parking lot and every temple and every place of worship across the state. That's a fantastic
Well, they came
option.
To me. They sort of said, hey, you're trying to find places where people are. Often on a Sunday, they'll come. In an hour, you get your car charged up, and you go into the church and get spiritually charged up. Why not?
At this point, do you feel that you need to support anything more in terms of what the state can do to support the overall initiative of putting more alternate powered vehicles into people's yards and garages and the ability to get them fueled, if you will?
Look, we're going to triple, quintuple the number of charging stations. We got incentives to get them in the condos, get them in the homes, get them on the major thoroughfares. Big subsidies right now to go buy an EV vehicle. I don't know how long they last, so it gives you an incentive to go get one right now. You don't have to worry about the Saudis and what they're doing to the price of gasoline.
Thank you, Governor.
John, nice to see you.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program for the people. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Austin James. Yes, I'm living with diabetes, but it doesn't have to define me. Thanks to the Freestyle Libre 3 Plus sensor, I get real-time glucose readings throughout the day. The Freestyle Libre 3 Plus sensor is small and easy to wear, giving me the freedom to focus on my life as a parent and a musician. Now this is progress. You can get a free sensor at freestylelibre.us.
Offer available for people who qualify. Visit myfreestyle.us to see all terms and conditions. Certain exclusions apply. Data on file, Abbott Diabetes Care, or prescription only. Safety info found at freestylelibre.us.